Hello, and welcome to Field Lab Earth, the podcast that's all about past and present advances in the fields of agronomic, crop, soil, and environmental sciences. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Lisa Durso about her paper, Assessment of Selected Antibiotic Resistances in Ungrazed Native Nebraska Prairie Soils, published in the Journal of Environmental Quality. I'm your host, Abby Morrison. Let's talk about science. Well, hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hi, Abby. I'm doing good.
Excellent. Why don't we just launch in and you can tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for inviting me to be part of this podcast. I'm a microbiologist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. So the USDA is a giant agency and there's 17 agencies inside of it. We are purely research. We have no regulatory role. So people think USDA, oh, the meat inspectors. That's a different part of the USDA. So we solve applied ag research problems across the United States, anything from insects to food crops, meat and poultry, fish production. The goal of the agency is to provide Americans with healthy soils and healthy, affordable food. So many of the items you know from the grocery store come from ARS research. So have you bought those sliced apples and they stay good for a long time without getting brown?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. The product that keeps them from browning is a result of the ARS research. Other things like carrots and tomatoes, frozen foods, sun butter, the lactose-free milk, the absorbent material in diapers are some of the other products that you know that come from ARS research. So it's a really great agency to work for. I used to work with food safety, hunting the bad E. coli on farms and in fields. My labs helped solve outbreaks from across the U.S. where bad E. coli was in petting zoos and at fairs. Now I work more broadly with microbes in manure. I don't know if you can hear my little air quotes there. So this is things like pathogens, so bugs that make you sick and antibiotic resistance, but also the good bacteria that help keep soil healthy and help to grow nutritious food. So my family jokes with me. They'll hear something about manure in the news and they'll say, oh, I heard about manure and I thought of you. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
Excellent. And we're going to be talking about antibiotic resistance today. So can you kind of give me an overview of what that issue is and what's involved with it?
You know, I sure can. It's something that we're hearing more and more about, and it's a really important problem. On the stats side of things, antibiotic resistance causes 23,000 deaths a year just here in the United States. This is according to the CDC. And approximately $55 billion in healthcare system costs. By 2050, so this is in just 32 years, if no changes are made, the number's expected to rise to 10 million deaths per year worldwide. So I thought, 10 million, how much is that? And that's approximately equivalent to the population of New York City and Chicago combined.
Oh my gosh.
So we hear a lot of scary things in the news. Yeah. You hear scary things in the news, and it is a scary problem, but there are a lot of people working on solutions. And when people talk about antibiotic resistance, I generally find the talk to be very confusing. So I've sorted it out. They generally are talking about one of three things: drugs, bugs, or genes. So the drugs, these are the medicines that we take or that we give to our pets and food animals. The bugs are the bacteria. These are living microorganisms. So this includes the bacteria that make us sick. And these are the ones we think of with antibiotic resistance. You're in the hospital, you get sick, and you can't get better because the antibiotics aren't working. But there's also a lot of other harmless or helpful bacteria that live naturally in the soil. So those are included too when we talk about bugs. And then the genes are the DNA instructions that code for resistance. So These can be shared among bacteria, much the way a recipe is shared. It's like if your mom has a banana bread recipe that I like, and so I say, ooh, good banana bread, may I have the recipe? Oh, sure, here you go. And so the recipe, it tells me how to make the banana bread, and once she gives it to me, we both have a copy, and we can both make the banana bread. And the same thing happens with these genes. They get shared between bacteria like a good recipe gets shared among us. So they call that horizontal gene transfer. Those are the three basics when we start to talk about antibiotic resistance: the drugs, the bacteria, or the genes. And the general thought is it's the use of the drugs that enrich for the bacteria and the genes. But that's not always the case. There are other things that can contribute to the bacteria and genes being around too.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great overview. Thanks. So for your specific research, now kind of maybe shifting gears a little bit, can you tell me what specifically you were working on with this project?
Sure. So there's a broad agreement that we want to be able to reduce antibiotic resistance on farms and fields. Everybody's on board with that. Okay, let's go. But then what does that look like in real life? So one of the first questions, so I kind of work in this area, this applied agriculture. How do we make things happen on the farm? So one of the first questions that came to me was, okay, well, what do we want to reduce it to? So the Right. question is basically, how low can you go? Is it zero? Is it realistic to aim for zero? And then as we look closer, it turns out that antibiotic resistance occurs naturally in soils and the environment, even when people aren't using antibiotics or giving them to pets or food animals. So if we want to know if something that a farmer does makes a difference, we need to know what's there to start with. Otherwise, we'll just go in and say, oh, there's resistance here. Oh, no. But we have to get more information so we can start sorting it out. It's what we're doing, changing it for the better.
Perfect.
So the question on this project was, what's a natural or baseline level of antibiotic resistance in our Nebraska soils? So once we know this, we can use it as a starting place to compare to animal production and crop production soils. That way we'll know what the farm is doing is changing and hopefully reducing the resistant bacteria and the resistance genes in the soil, in water and air, wherever we measure it. So we want to rule out what was there to start with.
Great. Yeah, that's a great question to ask. Can you tell me how you hoped to get your answers to that question, kind of what you did to do your experiment?
Sure. So we went into this as kind of a descriptive study. From what we knew, that antibiotic resistance occurs naturally in the soils. Soils are where antibiotics come from, and it's natural to find the resistance there too. We expected to find some kind of antibiotic resistance in the soils, but we didn't know how much or what kinds, and if it would be the same or different across the Nebraska soils. About 90% of the land mass in Nebraska is devoted to agriculture. So we wanted to find study sites that did not have ag impacts. So we started out brainstorming, where can we find soils that have not been impacted by agriculture, but still are fairly pristine in the natural states. And there were two options. One was, my boss was suggesting, cemeteries, because we know that a lot of them have fences around them, so animals aren't grazing. The second option was prairie soils. And so we thought the prairie soils was a better option. So we teamed up with the Audubon Society, Nature Conservancy, people at the university, and private landowners to identify 20 prairie sites in southeastern Nebraska that would serve as our study site.
Sure.
So
can you describe what those prairies look like, just to anyone who's not familiar?
Sure. So the landscape here is open, big open flat lands with very few trees and a big sky. It's what you think of when you think of the pioneers going west through the prairie. That's kind of the landscape here. And most of it's been converted to cropland, but there are still a number of preserved sites. And the sites that we worked with were native prairie sites. And most of them were virgin native prairie sites. So that means they have not been plowed ever historically, and that they contain the same kind of plants that were here initially before the pioneers came through.
Can I ask why these prairie sites exist? Like, who kind of fenced them off and said, don't go in here? And when, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, there are a number of public groups like the Audubon Society and Nature Conservancy, as well as a dedicated group of private individuals who are committed to preserving some of the native prairie soils. And so it's kind of a patchwork. There's a few sites that are fairly large. Most of the sites are modest, where you'll be able to stand at one edge of the field and on the horizon still see the ending edge of that prairie patch. But close to us here is a region called Nine Mile Prairie, which is a larger piece of conserved prairie. And we had a couple of those larger sites in our study.
Great.
So that's it. We got a team together over the course of 2 days. We collected from all 20 prairies. We luckily had good weather, and we got to meet a lot of very generous landowners who helped us find our way and allowed us onto their property. It was a big effort. The hard part after actually collecting the soils for us as microbiologists is that all of the soil samples that get processed have to get processed within 24 hours of collection. So we prepped for weeks and then had a marathon effort of collecting and then processing the samples.
Great. Can you tell me why it's so important that they're processed so quickly?
Oh, well, yeah. So what we were looking for was the living bacteria that are in the soils. So we wanted to be able to get an accurate representation. We were counting. We would put the bacteria on plates with the antibiotic and without the antibiotic. And then we'd grow them up and count them. And then we'd be able to tell, oh, there's this many on the plain plate, but only this many with the antibiotic. And then we'd be able to tell, well, the antibiotic was killing the bacteria. Or we'd be able to tell, oh, there's this many on the plain plate, and they all grew on the antibiotic, so they're all resistant to that antibiotic. If we store the samples, then the bacteria that are in the original sample can either die, or there's also some that like to grow in the cooler temperatures that could potentially grow. And so the bacterial community would change over time. That's why we need to culture right away.
Sure.
When we're doing gene-based work, we can take the sample and just pop it in the freezer and then later pull out the DNA. That's an easier kind of sample processing to look at the genes. And in fact, a lot of the environmental work, people look for antibiotic resistance in water and soil, will look exclusively at the antibiotic resistance genes, because then they can collect the samples, store them in the freezer, and then when they have time, process them. But getting the isolates is the gold standard, and that's what we did for this project.
Great. Can you tell me a bit about kind of the antibiotics you use? Because I know there's certain antibiotics that are stronger. So kind of what was your range for how you picked which antibiotics to test?
That's a good question, because there are a lot of different antibiotics. There's over 200 antibiotics listed as critically important on the World Health Organization list. So that's a lot of potential targets. Then CDC has a shorter list of 13 top threats, organisms that are resistant to certain types of antibiotics, and those are what's most important in people. We went in looking at resistances that were important and that other people had looked at in the environment. We looked at tetracycline. So this is an antibiotic that is frequently given to cattle and swine. And we also looked at cephalosporin, so a drug that's related to one that's important in people, and it's related to one that's used in cattle.
Sure. So moving on then, what did you find? What were your results?
Oh, the results, that's the fun part and fairly straightforward. So our results showed that antibiotic resistance is common, even in the native prairie soils. So that's not a surprise for us, but it can be surprising for some people. And more importantly, we have details on the specific types of antibiotic resistant bacteria and antibiotic resistance genes that were found in our soils. And that will allow us to use that as a starting point for comparing what's in the prairie soils to what's in agricultural production soils.
Great. Yeah. How does this tie in with kind of some of the public health factors that we've talked about? Like, why is this so important for just a day-to-day person, not just a researcher?
Yeah. So this matters on a couple of levels. First, on a general level, antibiotic resistance is really one of the major health threats of our lifetime. We use antibiotics for so many things, from earaches and preventative treatment during knee and hip replacements, to treating life-threatening infectious diseases. But we don't really know how resistant bacteria and genes get from animals in the environment into the bacteria that make us sick. We know it can happen. We assume it's happening, but we really don't know any of the details of how it might happen. If we knew better how it happened, we'd be able to stop it. We'd be able to say, oh, this is a place where we can do something to stop the bacteria or genes from moving into people. So this work that I do is just one small step towards a better understanding of the details of how antibiotic-resistant bugs and genes survive or die in the environment and how they might travel from farms to people. A second reason it matters is because we don't want to waste money and time implementing a solution that doesn't work. Whether it's public funds from the local, the state, or federal government, or private funds from individual farmers or companies, the resources are limited. We want to make sure that the limited resources are spent wisely and go towards efforts that give us kind of the most bang for our buck. And in this case, that's reducing resistance.
Sure. Talking about kind of looking forward, what future research is on the horizon for you?
Well, we recently completed a survey of antibiotic resistance in organic farming operations. So we're able to compare that now to the prairie soils to get a good idea of what farming without the routine antibiotic use looks like for our antibiotic resistance targets. So together, this information answers how low can you go? At least for our southeastern Nebraska soils. There may be differences in other regions or other parts of the country, but this gives us a starting place here in Nebraska.
Sure. And how, maybe you don't have the answer to this yet, but how useful would this Nebraska data be for, say, Kansas? Do you feel like it's kind of close, or is it pretty varied in your understanding from region to region?
Sure. The quick answer is that I don't know, but I would expect that Nebraska and Kansas would be fairly similar. We do expect differences based on soil type. You can see with your eyes when you look at soils from across the country, some are really deep black and some are brown, some are red. And so those differences that you can see with your eyes also result in differences for the kinds of bacteria that grow in the soil. And that affects the types of resistant bacteria and resistance genes that we find. But all in all, it's likely that when we're talking about antibiotic resistance, the specific agricultural production system is going to have more of an impact than geographic area. So for example, cattle might be more similar than to other cattle than to swine. Or if we have a large conventional operation that's using antibiotics routinely versus a smaller organic operation that's not using it. So we don't know the answer to any of these questions, but we suspect those are the things that are going to make more of a difference.
Sure. I've got three more questions for you. So,
oh no, I don't know if I have three more answers.
Oh boy. Well, we'll find out.
Go ahead. Go, go, go.
So question one is, if people would like to learn more about antibiotic resistance and these issues, where can they go?
The best place to go for information right now is a website hosted by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They have information on what you can do to help keep you and your family safe from antibiotic resistance. And I will get that link so you can post it on your site. And there's a second link that I will send you that has some good information, general information on antibiotic resistance.
Perfect. We'll have both of those in the show notes. Second question, if people are interested in helping with these issues, what can they do to be involved?
Yeah, there are actually things that people can do. Everybody, not just scientists, to help protect yourself and your family, and to help protect our communities, and to help protect our environment. We hear a lot about antibiotic resistance in food. And the good news is that many of the things you're already doing to keep your family safe from foodborne illness also help reduce antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So things like good storage and temperature control, thorough cooking of your food, preventing cross-contamination of raw foods, these all help reduce bacteria in general, including resistant bacteria that may be present on your food. The other thing is that we have powers as consumers to influence how our food is produced by voting with our grocery dollars. This actually has an enormous impact. Sometimes you do your shopping and you wonder, oh, does this even really matter? But I see from the production side of things, it's really driving farmers to make changes. If there's a market for these products, then the old production practices will be changed, adopting the new production practices that people want. So this provides a way for consumers to kind of partner with farmers to make changes possible. So for meat and fish, if you do this, look for labels that say raised without antibiotics. If it just says antibiotic free, that doesn't tell you for sure that the animal was raised without antibiotics. We have very good laws in the United States, and so the meat that you buy is all basically antibiotic-free. If animals had had antibiotics, they would have been withdrawn from them long before they went to slaughter, so the meat does not have antibiotics. So that antibiotic-free label can be misleading. Look for raised without antibiotics. So those are things that everybody can do, and that actually, in a real way, make a difference.
Yeah, that's great. So how much of kind of a two-way street is this with antibiotics? I mean, we talk about if it's in the soils, it can kind of transfer to the plants, and we're not really sure how that happens. But do you find that it kind of goes the other way? There are a lot of research into kind of the pathways back into the soil, or no?
So it does go both ways. There's a group of researchers who use DNA sequencing tools to study which bacteria are where and how the bacteria might be moving. And there's evidence that some of the bacteria originally came from humans and then got into animals. And that's perhaps through biosolids application to land. So when human waste products, fecal material gets, you flush it, and then it goes to the wastewater treatment plant, they sort it out and they take the solids and separate the solids and the liquid, and the solids eventually mostly end up being applied to farm soils. And then the liquids get released into the environment, into surface water, so once they're cleaned up. So there's definitely potential routes for things to go both ways. It's something that, again, we know is happening, but we don't know the details and we aren't able to quantify. So there's people working at both ends of the question to figure out what the dynamics are and the kind of the cycles between animals and humans and animals and the environment, tying them to both of those things together.
Sure. So final question, what is one fun fact about you that people wouldn't know if all they had was their research? Your research.
Okay, so fun fact, you'd probably not realize that I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I was not actively involved in agriculture until my 30s. So I'm a city girl, technically a suburban girl, and agriculture was new to me. I really like working in this field, and I think agriculture could benefit from people who grew up in suburban and urban areas participating. There's a lot of people who grew up in rural and agricultural areas, and I think I bring a slightly different perspective to the issue. And I learn a lot, and it's just really rewarding being connected to the land and being connected to food production and to humanity through time that has to eat. So it's a very rewarding place to work. But it took a little getting used to. I raised chickens a couple years back, and it took a lot getting used to eating the egg that was still warm that I just saw come out of the back end of the chicken instead of seeing it come out of the nice, clean egg carton. So that's my fun fact.
Well, thank you. That is a fun fact. So, yeah, thanks for being on the show. It's been such a pleasure to have you.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And if anyone has any questions or wants to contact me, feel free. I'll give you my contact information. You can post it on your website.
Excellent. We'll have that in the show notes, too. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Abby.
Thank you for listening to Field Lab Earth. If you'd like to find out more about today's topic, our featured article for this episode will be freely available for the next 2 weeks. You'll find a link to today's paper and other resources for this episode in our show notes or on our website. If you have any questions, comments, or recommendations for show topics, please contact us at podcast@sciencesocieties.org or on Twitter @FieldLabEarth. If you'd like to hear more content like this, please subscribe, and don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes or anywhere else you find your podcast if you like our show. This podcast is a joint production of the Tri-Societies, the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, and Soil Science Society of America. Special thanks to Lobo Loco for the use of their song Spook Castle on the intro and outro of our show. Opinions and conclusions expressed by authors are their own and are not considered as those of the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, Soil Science Society of America, its staff, its members, or its advertisers.